Good evening. My name is Dave, and I am an alcoholic. First, I'd like to thank Mike for asking me to speak. This meeting has a long-standing history and tradition. I'm just hoping that I'm capable of carrying a message that's worthy of its tradition. And one other thing before I start sharing, and there's a quote that I like to make part of my pitch. It goes like this. Sometimes a man can meet his destiny on the road he took to avoid it. And I'll get back to that quote towards the end of my share as I wrap things up in about 40 minutes. Anyway, I guess I should qualify. I was born on August 22nd, 1968. My sobriety date is August 12th of 2008. I began drinking and using right before I turned 12 and a half. So it gives me a drinking and using career of roughly 27 and a half years. And if I keep doing what's been getting me to bed sober on a day-to-day basis, in about 27 hours, I'll have 4 years of sobriety. Like a lot of us in the past couple of decades, my sobriety began in rehab. And to those of you who recently have gotten sober without the benefit of rehab, my hat is definitely off to you. I couldn't have done this without rehab. I actually didn't do a full 28 days. It was more like a 15-day detox. And life in rehab is rather regimented. You get woken up for breakfast around 7:30. There's a community meeting in the morning. There's a community meeting before dinner. And in between breakfast and dinner and lunch, there's various what they call meetings. But they're really classes. And for the most part, it's what they call cognitive therapy. And one of the more influential cognitive therapy meetings that I attended, the woman leading the class basically explained to us that there are four basic characteristics that have some kind of influence on alcoholics and addicts. The first one is genetics. The second one is environment, whether it be the environment you brought up in or maybe the environment you seek out. Which was my case more often. The need to self-medicate, or in some cases the imagined need to self-medicate, and big one that seems to be a common denominator for all of us, spiritual bankruptcy. Right off the bat when she was going down that list, I knew that I had scored on 3 out of 4 of those characteristics. The only one that's a question mark for me is genetics, because I'm adopted. Basically, I know not a whole lot about my birth parents. My mother was full-blooded German. She was a music major at UCLA when I was born. Her mother had been a piano teacher. Her grandmother had been a concert pianist. So I've got a fair amount of musical talent and artistic talent in my genes. But when it doesn't come naturally or easily, I have a tendency to just kind of do whatever comes more easily. I don't know, just the way I operate. As far as my father goes, I didn't know even less about him. He was supposedly half German and half Scottish, and there was a possibility he was either American Indian or African American or both. And from the description of his, I guess, interest in, say, forestry and naturalism, and given the fact that I was probably conceived about 2 months after the Summer of Love, there's a strong possibility that he was a hippie. which would give some possibility to the genetics having some kind of predisposition, in my case, towards drugs and alcohol. At least on his side. And since she was full-blooded German, hey, you know, those are good drinking genes too. So, I just basically decided that I scored 4 out of 4 in that category, or in all 4 categories. And, kept my ears open and took what there was to have. But as far as how I got started drinking and using at the age of 12 and a half, it's a little bit of a tale in the telling. My life didn't start out normally. I was a ward of the state until I was 3.5 years old. When I was 2.5, after living in foster families, I was placed with my parents who would end up adopting me, who I'll refer to now as Mom and Dad. Their names are Doug and Judy. My mom is basically full-blooded German, like my birth mother. My dad is roughly half German and kind of a mixture of French, Scottish, and who knows what else. So the genetic selection was pretty close to the mark. However, in my adoptive parents' cases, they're both scientists. My mom's a biochemist, my dad's a microbiologist. So, I was cast from a certain mold and being poured into another mold in terms of who was bringing me up. It wasn't all that bad. About halfway through the year that I was living with my parents, they decided that they wanted a second child. And the whole reason they even adopted me in the first place is my father having a Lewis Burke count. So they wanted a daughter as well as a son. So they basically selected a little girl from another foster home, and I was adopted at the age of 3.5, and within another 6 months or so, Libby was also adopted. And from the outside, we looked like, the model American family, two professionals working in fairly high-paying scientific fields, living in a nice house in Long Beach with a picket fence, but that was on the outside. Things were different with me from the get-go. I was born with a heart defect, and I was very sedentary, so I didn't get to play with the kids outside the neighborhood. I sat around watching TV or being read to. And in fact, when I was in the foster homes, they read to me, and apparently I picked up the whole thing of phonetic symbols and them correlating to sounds and whatnot. So my parents kind of carried the ball a little further and put the magnetic letters and numbers on the fridge, and by the time I was 3, going on 3.5, I was reading by myself, I wasn't reading Tolstoy or any classics like that, but, I was reading Curious George and Dr. Seuss and Richard Scarry books to myself, and I was just developing differently than my counterparts. I had open heart surgery at the age of 4.5, and after about 6 months of basically bed rest, I was cleared as far as physical activity as being normal. So I was finally able to ride a tricycle for longer than 15 minutes without turning blue and passing out. That's kind of cool. And, it was yet another example of things appearing normal on the outside but being different on the inside. Not too long afterwards, my father, who worked for Burroughs Wellcome Pharmaceuticals and was exceedingly good at his job, he had gotten a new territory that had just started up in Hawaii. And he made a flight out there and was checking out some of the outer islands, and he was calling us from Hawaii, telling us about this great travel agent who was seemingly jumping through hoops to set him up with cheap plane tickets to the outer islands, and how we were going to be flying out at a fairly cheap rate when we finally did move out there, and that sounded all great. That travel agent ended up being my stepmother in about 2 years. So although things had gotten good, things suddenly shifted. Within a year and a half of us moving to Hawaii, shortly before I was about 6.5, my parents had finalized their divorce. My father had moved out about 6 months before that, and was seeing my stepmother, of course. My mom started dating officers who resided in the condominium complex that we lived in just outside of Kaneohe Marine Corps Air Station. And after dating some of the officers and finding them a little too hoity-toity for her, she started dating some enlisted men and found them more to her liking. And she ended up hooking up with a guy who would end up being my stepfather. During this courtship, however, there was a good deal of drinking and partying going on. I mean, it was the early 70s. A lot of that was going on, at least in certain communities in the country. And ours was one of those. So I was watching the cause and effect of drinking and drunkenness. You know, I was watching Marines drink beer, get drunk, have fun, fall down, pass out. And you know, my maternal grandparents, who were both educators, had provided me with a set of encyclopedias before we moved, and provided me with another set of encyclopedias after we moved there. And you know, so given my early start with reading, you know, I'd look up things like alcohol and read about it, and read about the history of beer and wine and the Greek god Dionysus and things that six-year-old kids really shouldn't be doing or just don't do, but I was doing them. And to make a long story short, I decided I was going to try this stuff out. So one night, about 3 or 4 months before my 7th birthday, we went to my stepfather's best friend's place, and there was going to be a little bit of a party there. Bob, my stepfather, and his best friend Rod were chess enthusiasts. Bob had taught me how to play chess, so I was kind of anxious to see them play chess, but you know, it wasn't like watching football on TV. There wasn't a whole lot of action, and you know, I'm 6 going on 7, so my attention span is pretty short. And well, after I lost interest in watching what they were doing, moving their chess pieces, I started eyeballing my stepfather's big old goblet of beer that he was allowing to get warm. And I hadn't even tasted beer yet, but this goblet was, you know, pretty much like a schooner, maybe a little smaller. Held probably a beer and a half, maybe 2 beers, and it was about 3/4 full. And I just picked it up and took a taste and liked it, and bottoms up, it was down. And my mother was, you know, floating around being social, helping Cindy, the girlfriend of the host, run the party, and she'd come by and refill my stepfather's beer for him. But after she'd refilled it about 3 times, due to my help, she was getting a little irked because he was supposed to drive us home that night. I was, again, only 6 going on 7. My stomach was only so large, so I got full and I got tired of watching them play chess, so I trundled off down the hallway to one of the kids' bedrooms. And at that point in time, the original Hawaii 5-0 was still in production. And I had a piece of their merchandise. It was a little Hawaii 5-0 machine gun pistol with a removable magazine and 22 caliber pellets that you loaded in it. And it was semi-automatic. I mean, from about 10 or 15 feet, these things would leave a good welt. And I was in the kid's bedroom loading that magazine. You know, 3 or 4 bullets into it, the alcohol starts hitting me. And not really slow, but like really fast. I don't even think I had dinner that night. And I just kind of like dropped the gun and dropped the magazine. I was like, wow, I'm drunk. And I sure liked it. It was a great warm feeling, you know, and wasn't too unlike the feeling when I came off of anesthetic when I had open heart surgery. But, you know, I was like, wow, this is why people drink. You know, I like this. This is great. So I make my way back down the hallway, bouncing off the walls as I go. And in the meantime, my parents and the various other adults had put 2 and 2 together and figured out that I was the culprit. So I kind of made an appearance at the opening of the living room from the hallway and announced that I was too walk the drunk. And in the style of the time, Rod and Cindy had large pillows and beanbag chairs as opposed to having chairs and couches. And I basically did a face plant on the biggest pillow where my parents and Rod and Cindy were both kicked back and passed out. The next thing I know, I was being carried downstairs at night. It was still daylight when I passed out. And, I passed out on the way home. I woke up momentarily to find a sandwich being placed in front of me, which I ate, and I promptly passed out on the plate after I finished eating it. And time-lapse photographs were taken of this sequence of me eating the sandwich, at least. And little did my parents or anyone else know that that would be a precursor of what was to come not too far down the road. My stepfather, being the Marine that he was, barring an exceptional, exemplary performance, would be facing relocation at least every 3 years. And as it turns out, when they got married 2 or 3 months after my first drunk, within about 3 more months, he got restationed to Camp Pendleton. We spent 3 years there. But after 3 years, we were faced with his dilemma of either going to Okinawa for 1 year unaccompanied, going to drill instructor school, which he didn't think he was cut out for, or him going to recruiting duty. And in the meantime, he and my mother had basically brought a child into the world, and she was about 2 and a half, and they didn't want to put her through separation of 1 full year with him being gone. So he tried recruiting school. He didn't do so well. He placed in the middle of his class, and he drew Dover, New Jersey as his recruiting station. So we were downgrading in terms of areas that we were residing in. We started off in Hawaii. We moved to Southern California, which wasn't so bad. So my mom's whole side of the family lives here. And then we're heading to beautiful Dover, New Jersey, right in the middle of the 1978 World Series, which I wasn't too happy about because I was watching the World Series on a Sony TV about that big in black and white. But I was watching the World Series, so it wasn't the worst thing in the world. It just wasn't what I was hoping for. Now, we got to New Jersey, and part of my dad's recruiting tactics, I guess you could say, were throwing keg parties for these 17, 18-year-old guys who were hopefully going to be enlisting into the Marine Corps. We had a house in the countryside, if you want to call it that, in New Jersey, because there is actually some countryside in New Jersey. The northern part of the state is actually dairy farming territory, and we were relatively close to the Pennsylvania border, to the point where 2 of the teams in my little league division were actually in Pennsylvania. We had to travel to another state to play against them, whereas I was used to playing all my teams in the same community here in California. So it's changing culture, which was kind of cool, but altogether different. But mind you, we had these keg parties, 3 or 4 of them, no more than that. And yours truly was tapping the keg for all these kids, which they thought was novel. And they allowed me to have, 2 or 3 beers, and were monitoring my intake, or so they thought. They'd ask me how many I had, and it was like I was being pulled over by a cop. Oh, 2, 3, when it was really like 4 or 5. And, later in the evening, poker would be played, and later in the evening, drinking games would be played. I got to play quarters with people 10 years my senior in the living room of my own home. I watched this guy consume about $1.50 in quarters because he couldn't seem to manage to not swallow the damn quarter when he was made to drink, which was humorous, but, something I actually learned from. The bottom line is that every time I got the drink, I couldn't wait to drink again. And that's just what it came down to. I was a couple of years away from where I was going to start seeking out on my own. And after a couple more moves, we were in Hawaii, back where my parents' relationship, my mother and stepfather's relationship had started. And we did a lot of moving during that span of time. I've counted up the number of schools I went to from kindergarten through my senior year of high school. I went to 7 elementary schools, 2 junior high schools, and 3 high schools. That's 12 schools in 13 years. So by the time I was in 8th grade, I was on my 9th school. I was living in a society that I didn't really like too much. I wasn't very happy with the life that had been provided to me by my parents. Although I didn't want for much, I never missed a meal. I had the best that they could afford, which wasn't a lot of my stepfather's salary. My expectations of life had not been met, and that was a problem. But I had a solution to my problem, at least a temporary one. Life was a whole lot more tolerable and sometimes even enjoyable when I was buzzed. Whether that was alcohol, marijuana, or any mix of other things I could get my hands on, which would happen in the near future, that's the way it was. And so it went. It didn't get bad right away as far as problems, although it got bad earlier than I ever hoped it would, because I ran away from home in eighth grade, and a friend of mine had written a note to a girlfriend mentioning the fact that we drank beer and smoked joints and all this stuff. My parents had found that note while ransacking my room trying to find clues as to where I was during the 2 weeks that we ran away. So boom, 1 year into my career, I've been exposed. And from that point forward, I was always under the microscope. And I had to do a real, real good acting job on a day-to-day basis, which I didn't do too bad of a job at. But eventually, no matter how careful I was, how smart I thought I was, something would always start coming apart. My grades would start slipping, or my parents would see behavioral changes in me, like not coming home for dinner for, like, say, 2 or 3 months in a row. And they'd bust me. Right after the runaway thing in eighth grade, they sent me to group therapy. And after a year or so, the group therapist got married, and I seemed better. My grades had improved, because the whole reason I was even in trouble in the eighth grade before I ran away from home was because I'd gotten an incomplete in one of my classes for the first time in my life. I hadn't gotten an A or a B, and my parents flipped. So I got put on lockdown, and after 6 months of lockdown without relent on their part, I ran away from home. You know, so they let me off restriction, and made me carry around this daily report card to my teachers, and since I didn't really change my behavior, I just made them think I changed my behavior. I got really good at forging signatures, both of my teachers and my parents and administrators, and really good at lying. So my freshman year goes by, the group therapist gets married, and I'm cut loose at the beginning of 10th grade, and I don't know what got into me, but I just decided to, basically not do much in the way of schoolwork. I did okay in classes I liked and classes I didn't like algebra. I'd go to the class and I'd be reading a fantasy or science fiction book or listening to my Walkman in my big hair, because I had hair down to here that was out like this, and I could hide the headphones in my hair and you wouldn't know that I had it on unless I had it loud enough for you to hear. So consequently, my GPA went from like 3.33 at the end of my freshman year to a 1.6 in the first quarter of my sophomore year. My parents flipped out again. This time it was no group therapy, it was a psychiatrist. And lockdown again, and I decided that, okay, if they're actually serious about this thing, maybe I should really try quitting. So I did. And aside from a time later in my life when I was incarcerated for 60 days, that period of time, I'm not even sure how long it was the only other time that I actually stayed clean and sober. It was roughly 60 to 90 days, I'm guessing. I didn't keep track. I didn't write it down. I don't know what the start date was, the finish date was. The bottom line is that my psychiatrist felt that my parents should let me off restriction because he had seen a great amount of improvement on me, on my part. And I conveyed that to my parents, and he talked to them, and they weren't having it. And then there was an issue with him and Billy, and they started having conflict, so I just stopped seeing him altogether. And next thing you know, we're moving to 29 Palms because my stepfather was being restationed again. And that really sucked. It wasn't so bad going from Hawaii to Oceanside the first time around, but going from paradise to purgatory, that was not cool. But the thing was, though, with all these moves, you know, I was having my little problems even earlier in elementary school with, say, citizenship. You know, I was cussing in class or getting in fights or stealing people's stuff or getting caught with a pack of cigarettes. Every time we'd move, my parents would let me know I was getting a second chance and another second chance. When we moved back from Hawaii to 29 Palms, I was getting another second chance. And, you know, and I got in trouble in record time. It's like reading chapter 3 in comparison to my childhood, just slightly different context. You know, I finished off my sophomore year in 29 Palms High School and then went through my entire junior year there. And the night before I was supposed to see my father, which was, I was going to see him on July 4th, and he resided in El Toro at the time, my parents went to go play softball, and they were going to be gone until about 11 o'clock, and I got a wild hair up my ass to take the family car for a joyride. And got a ticket. I didn't have a driver's license. I had a permit, but I had two friends in the car with a large amount of drug paraphernalia, some empty containers, and I was in a peck of trouble. But one of those skills I developed a couple years earlier when I was under their scrutiny with the daily report card thing was my lying. I convinced the San Bernardino County deputy that I had a driver's license. See, the computerization of DMV had not really taken place yet. And I gave him my best pitch, and he bought a hook, line, and sinker. You know, a California Highway Patrolman who pulled up and was kind of privy to the situation wanted to bust me hard. But I convinced this deputy, and he convinced the Highway Patrolman that they were going to just write me a ticket and let me drive home. Woo! Another second chance. Well, needless to say, the next day, I went to my dad's house. My mom and my stepfather knew nothing about this ticket, but things had been breaking down between my stepfather and I. I mean, we'd squared off a couple times that year. My mom had stepped in like Mills Lane, breaking up a pregame pre-fight shoving match, and I basically told my dad that things were coming to blows and that I needed to move out or I was going to leave. And he said, well, I guess you can move in for your senior year. And then I had to come clean about the ticket, which I did, and then we had to call my mom, which we did. That's when I got thrown out of her house before I could move into his house. And I'd finally gotten what I wanted. I'd gotten out of their house, living at a lower middle class income level, and moved into their house at a lower upper class income level. But unfortunately, my dad had taken in a juvenile delinquent and knew nothing of what to do with them. And before my senior year was over, he wanted me out of his house too. And I wanted out, and that's just the way it was. Within a year of being out of the house, I was a convicted felon. I went to a Grateful Dead show and didn't come back for 60 days. Because I had 187 hits of LSD in my possession. And I was facing state time. But, I once again came up with what sounded like a good line of bullshit. And I stuck to it. And I went up to Superior Court, waist chains and ankle shackles, and they had finally given me a different public defender who thought that it was novel that he was finally defending someone for LSD instead of PCP, speed, or alcohol, and he went to bat for me. And instead of getting a year in the county and 3 to 5 years probation, I got 120 days and 2 years probation. And because it was close to Christmas time, I got cut loose at 60 days. And came back home to El Toro, I was living at the time, without a large number of my constitutional rights. I'd started going to school after graduating high school. I'd been doing well before I got busted, so I, you know, stuck to my guns. You know, I wanted to start a magazine publication, you know, try to change the world and overthrow the government or something like that, you know. And, you know, so I re-enrolled in my classes and went back to school, and basically I got involved with a really attractive female who was a walking probation violation for me to be even associated with. She had a really bad drug problem, and I thought I could help her, but it turns out that I couldn't. And her drug problem became my drug problem, and needless to say, the next 2 years of school were a waste of time and money and effort for the most part. I finally made one last geographic. I moved down here to San Clemente to get away from her. And, I'd gotten off probation, but while on probation, I had gotten a wet reckless, and I'd gotten my very first court card. And I went to 15 meetings during the last week and a half that my PO had given me time to go to 15 meetings, and basically got an overdose of AA that I didn't want, and swore I'd never be here again. Right before I moved down here, about a month after getting off probation, I got a DUI. I mean, I only blew a .18, but it was about 3 hours after I'd stopped drinking. I'd been at a birthday party drinking off a keg, and I could barely walk or operate my car. When I tried to leave, I went back in the house, sobered up, and when I left, I was doing the 1-2-3-4-4-3-2-1. And I actually passed 5 out of 7 sobriety tests that the cop gave me before he finally decided to take me in, because he wasn't sure if I was drunk. He just pulled me over initially because I was following too closely. I'd started drinking on a daily basis while I was on probation, because I had to. I was getting tested. And after I got off probation, I didn't stop drinking on a daily basis. And as more time went by, I started to rely more on alcohol than I had been relying on anything else. And, things just started falling to the wayside. At the age of 24, I finally dropped out of school because it just wasn't working. And committed myself to working and having fun. I made decent money at the job I had. Had a contact lens and sunglass distributorship. And I managed to keep that job for about almost 7 years before my attitudinal problems cost me my job. Because I got stoned every morning before work. I got drunk every day at lunch. I got drunk every day after I got home from work. And I repeated that cycle on a daily basis. I'd act like I was angry just so you wouldn't talk to me, and that's the way I had to operate to make things work. I ended up losing that job, and within about a year or so, my maternal grandmother passed away, and I had gone to jail for yet another poor choice in decisions. I had bought a vehicle from a friend without a driver's license. The car was registered, and I thought I was safe driving it around until the registration expired, and I couldn't get the new tags because I didn't have insurance, and I kept on driving the truck, and I got pulled over, and for someone with a triple-digit IQ, I did a lot of stupid things. We're approaching like the last 10 years of my drinking here. And my grandmother dies, and I start drinking really, really hard to the point where friends are having interventions with me because I'm making female friends of mine from high school really uncomfortable when they're around me when I'm drinking. And so I cool out for a little while, and I go back to just drinking beer, more chapter 3. A couple years go by, grandma passed away. Right at the end of 99, December 22nd of 1999. She almost saw the year 2000. Another year goes by and 9/11 happens. I was working as a defense contract salesperson at that point in time. And, that affected all of us a lot. It didn't really affect my drinking too much, more than it was already. But about 5 weeks after that, a dear friend of mine got murdered. And that affected my drinking. We had been hanging out 10 minutes up until the time that he was stabbed to death. And he was actually supposed to be coming back to my apartment to have a couple more beers, smoke some dope, and then he was going to go home. And he never made it back to my apartment. In fact, the last time I saw him alive, he was being loaded into the back of an ambulance. So I was really questioning the universe because I didn't believe in any kind of God as to why I was here, why my friend wasn't, point. His 12-year-old daughter was going to finish out her life without her father, to see her graduate from high school, walk her down the aisle, et cetera, et cetera. And, so I basically started crawling inside a whiskey bottle and stayed there for the next 7 or so years. I kept on working steadily because I had to fund my alcoholism and my drug addictions and pay the rent. And but as my disease progressed, I guess my standard of living increased too, and eventually my cost of living was at war with my cost of entertainment, to the point where I was doing some really creative financing on a monthly basis just to make everything work. And I sustained that for a long time, but it took a lot of energy. And at one point, I finally got an apartment of my own again after roommating with people for several years. And, I bit off more than I could chew. The rent in the apartment was too much for me to afford, even without my drinking addiction and the cost thereof. The wheels fell off. And versus asking anyone for help, whether it be financial assistance to get me out of the jam I was in, or asking my employer to put me into a rehab, I decided that the best solution to the problem, since the eventual result I saw with my life was me turning into one of the homeless guys that I saw living next to 7-Eleven when I was riding the bus to work, was to just remove myself from the picture altogether. In the program, you probably hear reference to a permanent solution to a short-term problem or a temporary problem. And, I basically decided to take my own life. And, I wanted to choose the most, bad karma-free form of suicide. I didn't want to jump in front of a train and traumatize some engineer or cause an accident or anything like that by stopping a vehicle in front of a train track or a train. I didn't want someone to find my dead body hanging, because I had friends who had taken themselves out like that before. I didn't trust the pill thing, because they can pump your stomach if they find you soon enough and you just end up living. So I decided the best thing to do and the most cost-free way of getting the job done was to find myself a nice high point to jump off of and hopefully not be found. And the best thing I could think of was the Coronado Bridge down in San Diego that spans Mission Bay. So on the morning of August 11th, right after the San Clemente Street Fair, which was on the 10th, I got up early, took the bus to the MetroLink station, I hopped on a train. Didn't call in to work, of course. What am I going to do, call in suicide? No, I just didn't call in. I actually ran into a drinking buddy of mine from Mulligan's who had a six-pack of beer with them, so the day got started off right. I was taking the edge off from the day before because I had closed Mulligan's the night before. We made a stop in Oceanside. I opened up a bar there, did a good deal of drinking until it was time to go to the main attraction. I hadn't gotten lucky the day before, so I figured I was going to get some female attention of some sort, even if I had to pay for it. And lap dances actually ate up most of the rest of my drinking money for the rest of the day, which might have saved my life and the ultimate outcome of things. Around 3:30 in the afternoon on the 11th was the last drink that I consumed, and I haven't had one since then. But I was stinking drunk. I'd been doing Jameson and beers, like two of each per hour since opening that bar and then going to the main attraction. So I was probably pushing a 0.3. And I made my way to the train station, hopped on the train, and I'd actually done such a good job of spending all my cash that I could only afford a ticket to Solana Beach, and I needed to get to Old Town. So I'm thinking to myself, what am I going to do with this situation? I'm like, well, I'll just hang out until the conductor comes by checking tickets. And the conductor didn't come by checking tickets until we were approaching Old Town, which is the stop just before the gas lamp. And unfortunately, that's a hell of a walk, and I ended up making that walk. Ironically, as I was starting off that walk, right across the street from me was the San Diego County Psychiatric Hospital, and I actually kind of stopped and looked at that building and considered going across the street and telling him what I had in mind, and I was like, nah, it's a bad idea. And I proceeded with my walk. I had decided I was going to wait until darkness. I was dressed all in black so that people wouldn't see me falling, hopefully, and find me right away, and hopefully not see me and, you know, do anything to prevent me from finishing what I wanted to start. So I went and saw The Dark Knight, and I walked around the Embarcadero and checked out the bridge and tried to get my bearings because I didn't know where the on-ramp to the bridge was. And I made my way to it. And at any rate, I finally get to the bridge, and it's about midnight, maybe a little bit after, and I'm walking up this thing. And that's pretty steep. And I'm looking over every once in a while, and I'm getting higher and higher and higher. And I'm like, wow, this is really going to do the job. I finally did something right and planned something good. This is going to work. And the spot I picked was the apex of the bridge where it levels off for a short span. The bridge is about 2.1 miles long. And at the very apex, it's 200 feet high. So I was about 100 yards away from the spot I had picked out. And the two things I was worried about were either being hit by a vehicle and living, and not getting to work out my plan, or two, being stopped by a cop before I could work out my plan. And about 100 yards away from the spot I'd picked to jump from, I heard a vehicle start slowing down. Now, I'd been a permanent pedestrian for about 10 or 15 years due to not having a license, so I recognized the sound of a cop car from a mile off, and it wasn't a cop. So I turned around to see who it is, and this green four-door Jeep Wrangler. They just started making them that year. And this guy unrolls the passenger window, and he's like, hey, you need a ride? And I'm like, no. He's like, well, why don't you go into Coronado? And I'm like, no. And it was like a cartoon, you know. I saw the light bulb peer over his head and light up. And in an instant, he went from being, you know, the Good Samaritan offering me a ride to turning into a suicide prevention counselor and was imploring me to reconsider what I was thinking about doing and how much I was going to regret it and how much it was going to hurt everyone who knew and loved me and all this stuff. And I was really resisting. I mean, I didn't jump, obviously, but I didn't want to hear what he was having to say. But I looked behind him, and there's three lanes of traffic coming towards us. Mind you, there's no sidewalk or emergency lane on this bridge, because I guess it wasn't really designed for pedestrian use. And I decided that, you know, if I stay there and don't take this ride, I'm going to cause an accident. He's probably going to get wrecked, and I'm going to live through, and I'm just going to have more bad karma to carry around with me, and I'm not going to work out my plan. So I hop into his car, and we start driving. He introduces himself as Todd. I introduce myself as Dave. And he's like, why are you doing this? And I said to him, hey, you know, for someone as long-winded as me, I wrapped it up really quickly. I said, basically, I've been half-assing through life for the past 28 years. It's all due to alcohol and drugs. And I'm just sick and tired of it all. I want it to end. And his response was not something I wanted to hear. You know, because I had been the recipient of 3 court cards in 7 years' time, gone to 43 meetings, I forged 2 signatures in the last court card. And he said, well, I was right where you were about a year and a half ago. I've been clean and sober since then, and my life has turned around. And I'm just doing, you know, a Cartman or South Park thing like this. Like, you got to be kidding me. I'm thinking to myself, out of all the people who could possibly stop and pick me up on a bridge, it's got to be some Dudley Do-Right 12-stepper. Where is this luck coming from? And I'm staring out the window as we're driving along. We haven't finished the trip to the other side of the bridge. And, you know, how they tell you your life flashes before your eyes right before you're going to die. Well, I was experiencing something like that, but it wasn't my whole life. It was just all the bad shit and problems that had occurred in my life. You know, the various arrests that led to my court cards, my felony drug arrest, probation, the wreckage I had caused my family for decades. And I realized that, you know, after a lifetime of second chances, I was being given yet another one. And I decided that this time I was actually going to make use of it. So when he asked me where I wanted to go, I wanted him to take me, I said, well, I guess you better take me to a hospital treatment center. And he said, okay. So as we're getting to the very end of the bridge, you know, the span of time here is maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes, with our conversation, my revelation, all this stuff. I guess you could call it a spiritual experience of some sort. I noticed there's a CHP officer parked at the toll booth, and I said, hey, Todd, why don't you do yourself a favor and just stop here, and I'll turn myself over to custody of this police officer, and you can go home. He's like, all right. So we did that, and guess where they took me? They took me right back to the San Diego County Psychiatric Hospital that I'd been standing across the street from about 8 hours before. Now, is that bitter irony or what? Now, that's where my sobriety began, but luckily, that's not where I did my detox. I got moved to Aurora Behavioral Health Care Center in Rancho Bernardo, and from there, I came back home to San Clemente. I met my sponsor, John, at day 32 when he was taking his 15-year chip. He had something I wanted. It wasn't his watch or the car that he was driving. It was the change that had been brought about in his life by recovery. We started working the steps, and I've gone way overboard here. We did 4 and 5. You know, after going back over 1, 2, and 3, I thought I was on the third step, but we kind of retraced my steps and made sure that I had things going right. We made it through 4 and 5 at around the 6 month point in my life of being sober in 2009. And that was probably a good thing because my life had been good for about 6 months. Bad things started happening. My mother had a liver transplant that wasn't related to alcoholism at all. My grandmother, 93 years old, on my dad's side, passed away. I was able to be of service for him and actually lay her body to rest in the family plot here in California. He lives in Texas, and she had been residing in Colorado. And then my father had a heart attack and a triple bypass about a month after that. Not once did I pick up a drink. Now, 6 months earlier, any one of those things would have been more than an excuse I needed to pick up. But it wasn't. You know, the first thing I did when I heard about my mom was I prayed. The next thing I did was I called John. And then I got to a meeting as soon as I could later on that day. You know, and I've been doing things like that for the past 4 years, and it's been keeping me sober. As cathartic and therapeutic as step 4 and 5 are, I think step 8 and 9 are even more so. The biggest deal with 8 and 9 for me was forgiving. Let's see. Before I placed the first name on my list, I said a little prayer. I forgive anyone and everyone who has ever harmed me at any time and under any circumstances. That was really hard for me to do, but it was necessary. Especially with my sister, who had blackballed me from her wedding back in 1998, and who I haven't seen since my grandfather passed away in 2002. You know, I've made an attempt at amends with her. She seemed fit not to accept my amends. But in virtually every other direct amends that I've made, it's been received well, particularly on my dad's side of the family, where there's a rich relationship, especially with my baby brother, who's 19 years younger than me. Another part of what I've gained back from working the program, aside from getting a life that's worth living, not just a pitiful existence, I was able to track down some of the friends that I hung out with back in Hawaii, back in my sophomore year and before. Two of them reside in the Bay Area, one in San Francisco and one in Berkeley. I found them online 2 years ago. I started visiting them on a regular basis. Last year, I've been up there four times or so since then. And during my most recent visit in June of this year, I was at a Giants game versus the Rangers. My dad, living in Texas now, is a former Dodger fan, now a Ranger fan. And a married couple sat down next to my friend Charles and I. And they were wearing Ranger colors. And I took a picture of the ballpark and I sent it to my dad along with a text telling him that my friend Charles and I were sitting next to two Ranger fans. And he called me back within about 20 minutes or so. He's like, "You better be rooting for the right team." I'm like, "Of course I'm rooting for the right team. I'm in San Francisco. I'm rooting for the Giants." And I did this loud enough so that the couple on the other side of my friend Charles could hear. And they were amiable and took it well. And not so much while I was having the conversation, but after I got off the phone, I had to stop and just absorb the moment, because that phone call with my father from that ballpark, sitting next to one of my old friends from 23 years since, being friendly with my fellow man who I'd never met before wearing the opposing team's colors, would not have been possible without the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. In no way, shape, or form, let alone me even being here. So, back to that quote. Sometimes a man can meet his destiny on the road that he took to avoid it. On August 11th, I saw what I thought was my destiny before me. I took a road that I thought was going to help me avoid it. And on the Coronado Bridge, I ran into my friend Todd, who I'm actually trying to find right now and haven't been able to do so, who pointed out an unseen fork in the road, which has led me to a path of far happier destiny than either of the two roads that I would have had otherwise. So, with that, I'd just like to say thanks for being here. I hope that I carry some sort of message that you can use in your recovery or maybe the recovery of somebody else you know. Thanks for letting me share.